This is The Guardian.
If cybercrime was a country, it would be the third biggest country in the world in terms of gross domestic product. It would also be the fastest growing economy in the world.
Microsoft's chief security advisor, Sarah Armstrong-Smith. But our business is ready for how cybersecurity will be transformed by Gen AI.
Take on tomorrow from PwC's Strategy and Business.
Guten Tag, pod fans. I didn't write that. Max Rushton here from The Guardian Football Weekly. Euro 2024 kicks off on the 14th of June. We'll be releasing pods every day of the tournament. We'll be joined by pundits across the continent, giving unique and expert insight into every team at the competition, alongside of the host of Guardian journalists out in Germany. Until then, bis bald. Tschüss. New episodes out every day from the 14th of June. Listen wherever you get your podcasts. Tschüssi.
Prime Minister, have you blown the election? Rishi Sunak is under considerable pressure.
On reflection, that was a mistake, and I apologise for that, but I'm very happy to admit when I've made a mistake. That's what you always get from me.
Keir Starmer confirmed this earlier this week. They are going to put up your taxes by £2,000.
That's a lie.
By £2,000.
Carla Denyer.
That was terribly dignified, wasn't it?
And it's Saturday morning. You are out playing tennis on the campaign trail in a park. Why?
I'm Lisa Nandy, and I am nicking Angela Rayner's bus. It's no longer the Ange bus. It's now the Nand wagon.
I'm Pippa Carrera.
And I'm Kieran Stacey.
You're listening to Politics Weekly Westminster for The Guardian.
All right, Pippa, how was Keir Starmer?
I'd use one word to describe him today. Upbeat.
Upbeat, because you've been out with him on the campaign trail in Essex. You've done a news story about childcare, which we'll come on and talk about. But I'm kind of interested in just seeing what the mood was like. He was relaxed, you were saying, right?
Yeah, so we were at this community centre in Thurrock in Essex. And we were all sort of milling around in the garden outside, and the sun was shining, and everyone was sort of saying, oh, thank goodness it's a summer election after all, if it's not necessarily the right decision for Rishi Sunak and the Tories. Well, again, we'll come on to that later too. It's certainly, you know, it's better than campaigning in the rain, right? And lots of Starmer's team were there, both directors of, you know, communications and policy, but also his private office team. Felt like everyone had sort of thought, well, it's Sunday morning, the sun's shining, I'll come out. And he strode around the corner with Yvette Cooper, the Shadow Home Secretary, looking very jolly, had his sleeves rolled up, sort of stood in front of this small crowd of activists, of Labour Party activists, waving banners. And he just seemed a lot more relaxed than I've seen him so far in the campaign, when, you know, he wasn't expecting it. None of us were expecting it to be called right now. And it feels a little bit like all of us, and I'm sure I can include journalists as well as politicians in this, we may have had plans in place, but actually pressing the button and getting those plans going takes a little while. And it feels like he took a little while to get into the groove. But today, at least, it looked like he'd got there.
I wonder if he's starting to believe he's going to win, because he's been so controlled for so long. And the message, obviously, coming from Labour HQ has been, you know, no complacency, we're not taking anything for granted. The Ming Vars, which obviously we've talked about several times on this podcast. Do you think he's now starting to feel more confident? Is he?
Almost certainly. I mean, how can he not? Because not only is all the polling suggesting that Labour's in the lead, he also just needs to look back at the Conservative campaign of the last week. You know, the arrival of Nigel Farage and the fallout from Sunak's D-Day blunder. It's probably not surprising that even this most cautious of men has come to the conclusion that you know, he's set for government. And actually, it's quite interesting, though, because I was asking him about complacency today, because that, of course, is one of the dangers, that lots of people want rid of the Tories, so won't vote for the Tories. But whether they then switch to vote for Labour is another matter. And lots of them will just decide to stay at home. So particularly if they think that Labour's a dead cert for victory anyway. So I asked him about whether complacency was going to be an issue, either, you know, particularly if the, he and the party were kind of projecting this sort of expectation that they were going to win. And he said that he'd said to himself, he made a point of reminding himself every single day that not a single vote has been cast yet. And you can just imagine
that
him, can't you, standing there sorting out his hair in the bathroom mirror in the morning, you know, that wonderful quiff, and
with
just saying to himself,
mantra,
saying, no votes have been won yet. But, you know, it's not a bad thing to do because, yeah, as we know, we live in predictable times. And while things look pretty dismal for the Tory campaign right now, you know, we've seen in the last few years how events can come along and just, you know, completely change the course of history.
I wonder if a more relaxed Keir Starmer will actually do better. We've often asked him and the Labour Party, haven't we, whether it matters, whether they think it matters that Keir Starmer is not the most charismatic of politicians. I think it's fair to say that he's not. And the answer that we tend to get back is, well, actually, people don't want charisma now. They've had enough of charisma. They've had enough of drama. They just want something a little bit calmer, a little bit more in control. They want to return to kind of decency, but also competence.
I'm thinking you're about to get on to the fact that you don't agree with that.
I don't agree with that. It's exactly what I was going to say. I don't think that's actually true. I think people do want to feel a bit of hope. They do want to feel, you know, like they can believe in their political leaders. And, you know, I wonder whether that might play for him just to be able to loosen up a bit.
I did ask him about hope as well. In fact, I reminded him that I've asked him about hope at pretty much every interview I've done with him for the last 2 years, because, of course, he's focused so much on reassurance, both economic reassurance, national security reassurance, trying to show that it's a different party from the one that Jeremy Corbyn led, a changed party. What I've always wondered is whether reassurance is enough. Do you, in order to get that vote out, do you also need to be able to provide people with a little bit of hope? And he did acknowledge the importance of that today. He said, look, it's true that people are pretty fed up with what's happened the last 14 years and said, I've had enough of that. But there's been plenty of times in history where they've had, to use his words, pretty awful Conservative governments, and yet Labour hasn't got over the line. So I think he knows that it's not automatic that people will get to the position that they think, that he thinks they're coming to now, of wanting to put their belief in Labour, and that there's still work to do. When I was talking to him, I wondered whether the promises that we have heard so far from Labour and the things we're likely to hear in their manifesto later this week were just going to be the baseline. After all, they called them their first steps of government. And I gave the example of in 1997, when Tony Blair, one of his key pledges going to the election was to cut waiting lists, NHS waiting lists, by 100,000. And in the end, of course, ended up eradicating them completely. So I asked Starmer about this and said, look, are these, all these things just really a starting point? And can we expect to see more? Trying to kind of draw out of him whether they are going to be bolder, and we are going to hear more, you know, if they do win, when they come in, about what they might do. And he said, absolutely, exactly that. So I do think we can expect more. I mean, I know a lot of people may be sceptical of that and him actually being able to deliver on that in government. But I did think it's interesting that they are at least acknowledging that people need that bit of sort of inspiration.
Yeah, well, let's talk about one policy where this may be just the start, because the policy that Starmer wanted to talk about with you was about childcare, right? So Labour is going to offer, I think, is it 100,000 more childcare places through primary schools, which is a model that they've been looking at for a little while. This is a kind of top-up offer to what the Tories offered a couple of budgets ago, where they suddenly expanded the childcare offer hugely, a lot more money.
Which we had leaked to us at The Guardian.
That's right, we were the ones who
the rabbit in the hat
one.
The day before Jeremy Hunt's budget.
But I remember just before that budget, Bridget Phillipson, the Shadow Education Secretary, given a speech in which she'd said this free hours model that the Tories have expanded, she was actually going to eradicate it completely. She was going to scrap it because it doesn't work, it doesn't fund the necessary number of places, and they were going to replace it. And the hints we were getting at the time was it would be something like this. It would be through maybe through primary schools, something a bit more, you know, state led, something perhaps with a bit more money behind it. Now, we're not there, are we? This is more of a top up to what the Tories are currently offering.
But it feels like they've come at it from another way. So we've kind of got to the position they might otherwise have wanted to be at, but by way of, you know, the government's funding that it's already committed to these extra hours for preschool children. But the problem, of course, was, as the National Audit Office and others have said, that even though the government said that ultimately by September 2025 they wanted all children of 9 months and over of working parents to qualify for these 30 free hours a week, which is actually, you know, a decent chunk, that they didn't have the sector didn't have the places available. So that's partly why they've got to doing it through schools. And the other advantages of school doing it through school is that generally, you know, it's high quality childcare, right? And it's retention of nurseries in schools tends to be better because there's sort of like the infrastructure around to support the nursery classes. And of course, one of the problems in the sector is not just recruitment in the first place, but also retention. The other big thing which Starmer's been getting us lots of questions about, including by me today, is of course tax.
Yeah, so you tried to pin him down a little bit. We revealed in The Guardian this week that there is pressure from within the party to raise capital gains tax in particular. And one of the reasons that we focused on that is because the party, Rachel Reeves, Keir Starmer, have been very quick to shut down any suggestion that they might raise income tax, VAT or national insurance. They have not mentioned CGT, which can be quite a big money earner for them. And I thought the response that you got from Keir Starmer on whether he might raise CGT at some point in the parliament was very, very revealing. What did he say?
Yeah, he said, "I'm not going to write 5 years' worth of budgets, 3.5, 4 weeks before an election." So it very much wasn't ruling it out. Yeah. But he did say, you know, everything's fully costed and fully funded, and that none of our plans require tax rises over and above the ones we've already set. But very specific questions, we're not getting very specific denials.
Yeah, well, as I was writing this week in The Guardian, I think one of the things that Rachel Reeves is going to do as soon as she gets in is to do a budget where she says, I've looked at the books and things are much, much worse than we were expecting. We're going to have to do things that we were not expecting to have to do before the election. Very sorry, but here are some tax rises for you. And the way that Labour people talk about this is having one shot at being able to do this, where you blame the previous government and you can probably just get about get away with it once, and then it becomes harder and harder. So I wouldn't be at all surprised. What I'm told is that she wants to seek what's called a doctor's mandate, which is where you take a look at the patient, you say, oh my goodness, you're so riddled with the disease, we're going to have to perform drastic surgery. And that's what I would imagine their September budget might look like.
Well, talking of previous governments, maybe we're getting a bit ahead of ourselves, describing the Tories as previous just yet. But the Conservative Party chairman, Richard Holden, has had a bit of a nightmare this evening, hasn't he?
Ouch. Yes, this clip has gone viral of Richard Holden, the party chair, getting quizzed by John Craig of Sky News about why it was that he put himself up for selection in Basildon and Billericay, a seat which is, I think, 300 miles away from his previous seat of North West Durham.
Which, of course, he'd protested he absolutely loved and
he
cared about the region.
Yeah, he was never going to do.
And how many people were on the shortlist for the panel in Basildon and Billericay?
Just Richard Holden.
Richard Holden himself. How convenient. But it wasn't anything to do with him becoming being Tory party chair, I assume.
Look, I mean, I feel a little sorry for him. Labour has done this all over the shop. You know, Labour just parachutes people in, no questions
asked.
They have shortlists of one all over the country. It's not entirely surprising to me that the Tory chair, and let's put it in context, his seat of North West Durham was abolished in the boundary review, which is why he was looking for a new seat and he couldn't find one in his area, so he needed to find one somewhere else. He obviously should have put himself through the same process that everybody else goes through. But, you know, it would have probably looked even worse for the party had he done so and then lost. So, yeah, that was a stitch-up. And he can't really defend it. And that's what came across in this clip where he was asked why on earth. And he tried to, he started talking about Emily Thornberry, which caused John Craig to completely lose his cool and say, I've had enough of this. You know, how can you possibly defend what you've done here? And he couldn't defend it.
So you can't justify the way you have been parachuted into Basildon and Billericay. You're not denying it's a stitch up and it's anti-democratic.
Emily Thornberry today has admitted...
I'm going to stop you now. This is ridiculous. This is ridiculous. You said in an interview earlier this year you were bloody loyal to the North East. What happened to that?
John, I've already answered these questions.
No, you haven't.
Actually, I have.
When?
When I did a Channel 4 news interview last week.
Oh, right. It's one broadcaster, isn't it? This is a pool interview for all the other broadcasters.
These broadcasters agreed to the questions.
No, nobody agreed that at all. Well, I've got a list here of questions from other broadcasters.
All three broadcasters agreed. Everyone on this.
Nobody's agreed. No, absolutely
not. Another reason I feel a little bit sorry for him, and you probably know about this a little bit better than I do, but The system with broadcasters, with pool clips, is a bit strange, isn't it? This isn't an interview, per se. This is supposed to be a moment where the politician just comes along with a pre-prepared line and gets to say it to the camera. Is that a kind of...
But then gets distributed, the responses that get distributed around all the broadcasters. And the idea is that rather than asking anything about your own agenda, you're asking, you know, a couple of questions on the issues of the day, which then any news bulletin can play out. Yeah. And of course, John Quigg didn't do that, did he? He clearly just decided he'd had enough.
Yeah.
You know, he's what we call a veteran lobby correspondent, isn't he, dear John?
Yeah.
And he's seen, you know, plenty of elections in his time. And I think he just reached the end of his tether and just thought,
clearly,
you know what, stop it. But it's, you know, it was just the latest example, I'm afraid, of how the Tories campaign is floundering. And, you know, we've seen right from the very off, we've talked about this before, but Rishi Sunak standing in the rain as he announced the election date, you know, going to Belfast and the Titanic Quarter to make an announcement. And then this week, this isn't a Tory gaffe, but Nigel Farage entering the fray, coming back to frontline politics, which is hugely problematic for the Conservative campaign. They thought they were then back on the front foot again with the debate, as we discussed, the £2,000 tax policy blow that he landed on Keir Starmer on Tuesday night. And then, of course, D-Day.
It's interesting, the way that the D-Day blunder, I think we can now officially call it a blunder, played out just for us in the media was kind of interesting, because I remember when on the Thursday afternoon, we were watching those.
In our office in Westminster, yeah.
Yeah, watching those TV pictures and looking, thinking, that's very strange. Something strange has gone on here, because there's three of the world's most important leaders and then David Cameron tacked on the end.
Yeah, and then a member of my family started messaging saying, I've just seen David Cameron on the TV with Joe Biden, Justin Trudeau and Emmanuel Macron. What's he doing there? Where's Rishi Sunak? Why is he not at the D-Day celebrations?
Yeah, that's when you know it's getting cut through, when your family WhatsApp group.
But this family member was getting more and more cross about it, and suggesting that actually it was really insulting that Rishi Sunak hadn't stuck around.
Well, and then it got worse, didn't it? Because then that evening we found out, we got a message saying that ITV had done an interview with Rishi Sunak, and here were some lines that we could use in that evening's papers.
Denying that he was a liar,
that's right. This was after the debate. And the first question everybody had was, when was this interview conducted? Mm. And it turned out it had been conducted that afternoon. Now, a couple of things to correct, because in the immediate aftermath, there was a lot of coverage saying that Rishi Sunak could come back for that interview. I think we've now discovered over the weekend that that was not entirely true. It had been planned for a while that he was going to take the afternoon away from those celebrations. And
because he felt he'd done the British bit of it, both in Portsmouth and then also on the Normandy beaches as well.
It's really confusing as to what exactly they were told by the French, because there was a fascinating piece in the Sunday Times by Tim Shipman today, where one of the things his sources have told him is that it seems to have been a bit unclear what the day was going to be like. And the suggestion was that the French had said that the second half of the day would be mainly French events and would be optional. And Number 10 didn't seem to cotton on to the fact that it would be actually a much more poignant and important bit of the day and be, you know, obviously very photogenic as well. Now, at some point, this must have become clear, and obviously they weren't nimble enough to actually realise it.
But also, as well as the Tories dropping the ball, Labour's foreign affairs team played a bit of a blinder. I mean, David Lammy, who has, you know, spent months building relationships with the Macron administration. You know, he's been tweeting in French. I don't know whether actually David Lammy speaks French or whether it's somebody in his team. But anyway, regardless, and he's been writing essays for intellectual Parisian magazines. Yeah. He's been building up this relationship. He basically got an invite, because neither he nor Keir Starmer were originally invited to the international event in the afternoon.
Yeah.
But he used his contacts to get them both admitted, and also to make sure that Starmer could shake hands and get a photograph taken with Volodymyr Zelensky, which was kind of, you know, the position you'd expect a British Prime Minister to be in, not a British leader of the opposition. So it wasn't just that the Tories played things badly. Labour also played things really well.
Yeah, and it just feeds into this idea of Sunak as not being in touch. I've often noticed, actually, Sunak doesn't like doing the international diplomatic circuit. He often cuts international trips relatively short compared to his predecessors. He doesn't like going and pressing the flesh. He'd much rather be back at number 10, head down, working.
Well, that's because he's had to, because let's face it, he's been pretty much on the back foot since he took over as Prime Minister. And it's odd for somebody who actually, if you were to ask him what he would consider like some of his successes in his time in Downing Street, you know, looking back in years to come, perhaps on his legacy, it would include things like the Windsor Framework, which was ultimately a piece of diplomacy about the Northern Ireland Border Protocol, and the AUKUS defence deal with the US and Australia. Yeah. And then, of course, he's continued Boris Johnson's support for Ukraine, putting Britain at the forefront of the response of Western support for Ukraine. So, you know, for somebody who, you're right, does prefer, look like he prefers to spend time at Downing Street, he nevertheless, you know, some of his, I think we'd all be fair to say, his successes are diplomatic issues.
But let me just highlight one thing as well, which, again, I've talked about before, and I think is a little bit part of this narrative about Rishi Sunak. And I'm going to read you a quote here from Nigel Farage. He said, this is about Sunak, "He doesn't really care about our history. He doesn't really care, frankly, about our culture. This man is not patriotic. Doesn't believe in the country, its people, its history, or frankly, even its culture. If you're a patriotic voter, don't vote for Rishi Sunak."
Yeah.
I think that part of the criticism about this is because Rishi Sunak is not a white man.
I think that's quite clear. For me, that has dog whistle racism running right through it. Our culture, our history. Right. What he's saying is not his culture, not his history, because his culture and his history are different. Yeah. Now, when Farage was pressed on this, he did, of course, say that he meant class and privilege rather than the colour of Rishi Sunak's skin.
Mm-hmm. Well, I tell you what, I'm also, like Rishi Sunak, a second generation Indian immigrant, and I know what I hear when I hear those words. Just before we move on, we like to throw quotes at each other.
Oh, no, here we go.
This week's Tory campaign.
It's not my turn, isn't it?
It's your turn, but I've got one.
He's got
you can
first.
Have two in a row. You can have two in a row in a bit. This week's Tory campaign reminded me of my absolute favourite quote, possibly of British politics.
This is going to be from the thick of it, isn't it? Or something like, it's not. It's real life politics.
It's real life. These are all real
Although
quotes.
Actually, the thick of it sometimes feels like real life.
Well, this sounds like the thick of it as well. It sounds like Malcolm Tucker. So trigger warning.
Okay.
There's a swear word. Who said this? "We're all fucked. I'm fucked. You're fucked. The whole department is fucked. It's the biggest cock-up ever. We're all completely fucked."
Well, I mean, I would answer Malcolm Tucker. Absolutely.
It wasn't Malcolm Tucker. That is a real quote.
But if it's, and it can't, you mentioned department, else I'd say Alistair Campbell. So it must be someone, it's a minister. Can you tell me which party?
It was Labour, not a minister.
Not a minister.
And you don't have to get the name, but you might remember why this department was completely fucked.
Is this about a good day to bury bad news?
That's exactly it. That
Stephen
is what it was.
Byers.
Yep.
It was Stephen Byers when he was, I think he was Trade Secretary, but you'll check that for me.
Yeah.
And Jo Moore, who I think was his spin doctor at the time.
Yeah.
She, and also the press chief in the department, Martin Sixsmith.
That's right, it was Martin
Sixsmith.
Yeah,
Martin Sixsmith. I mean, I remember actually where I was on, because the day, of course, was 9/11.
It was 9/11.
And subsequently it came out that she'd sent an email, as the Twin Towers were burning, suggesting that September 11th was a good day to bury bad news.
That's right. And so this was actually the Department for Transport, but it also encompassed local government. And the thing, and I only got this through looking it up, so don't give me too much credit, but the bad news she wanted to bury was councillors' expenses, apparently, on 9/11.
Do you know who the Shadow Transport Secretary was then?
Oh, no. No, go on.
Theresa May.
Ah, very good.
She wouldn't have used that language.
No, I can't imagine it. All right, so what do you think? Are they, to use that quote's words, completely fucked? Is there a way for this Tory campaign to get back on its feet?
Well, since everyone's swearing, I suppose I can too. I was talking to a Tory advisor at the end of last week and asked them, how's the campaign going? Expecting to hear some sort of, you know, nice spin back about how, it was hard, but there's a narrow path to victory. And, you know, we did well in the debate and all this sort of stuff. And instead of all of that, I got one word. fucked.
There you go.
So I think they think that they're not in a great situation. Certainly that clip we talked about with Richard Holden, I'd implore anybody that's not seen it to go and look at his face, because that face to me summed up the state of the Conservative Party at the moment.
Right, that was the most telling thing about it, wasn't it? It wasn't the answer, it was the way he just looked so... And we both know Richard
Holden.
He's normally upbeat, ebullient, he's, you know... He's
gravity-defying in his capacity to say that everything's okay when it clearly isn't. And he just looked utterly despairing.
Yeah. All right, so one thing that the Tories will hope helps them move on this week is it's manifesto week. All three of the main national parties have got theirs. First of all, the Lib Dems on Monday. Ed Davies ran this incredible campaign, which is just full of photo shoots, really. They're kind of almost... It's Willy Rennie, Boris Johnson-type campaign, where he just ends up in absurd situations. But obviously, they're going to do the serious bit now. And we hear that it's going to be based around the NHS and social care, which, again, plays into Davies' own personality and his strengths. He's a carer himself. So... The narrative ties in quite neatly, I guess.
Yeah, and then on Tuesday, we're expecting, although this hasn't been confirmed yet, we're expecting the Conservative campaign manifesto launch. I suppose it depends how the next 24 hours goes. But we already know quite a lot about what is going to be in there. And we've seen that throughout the whole campaign, the Tory strategy has been to make big policy announcements, like really eye-grabbing policy announcements. Some question marks as to whether they actually be able to afford them. It does feel like they're just chucking everything at this. But we've had national service. Mm-hmm. We've had this pension triple lock plus. Mm-hmm. I think we should expect to hear some stuff about stamp duty for first-time buyers. Mm-hmm. As Sunak attempts to revive his campaign with probably like more consumer-facing policies. And although we've been told that we shouldn't expect a pledge on inheritance tax, which of course was a key ask for right-wing Tories, it does feel like there might be some promises of, you know, jam tomorrow on tax for the Tories.
Yeah, a bit of, I wonder whether the stamp duty promise will end up sounding a little bit like their national insurance promise, which is over the course of a parliament, maybe even longer, we will aim to abolish it altogether. The good thing for them is that by kind of giving these very long timetables, they don't feel that they have to cost it in any way. They just say, you know, any money that we save or any money that gets generated during the next parliament extra will be used to fund that particular pledge. And so this could end up being another expensive tax pledge. Now, I imagine that the good people at the Institute for Fiscal Studies will be absolutely tearing their hair out if that is at the heart of a Tory manifesto on Tuesday, because there already looks like there's some fairly large black holes in public funding over the next 5 years. But one of the things almost that's going for the Tories right now is they can make pledges like that because people aren't examining them as ruthlessly as they might if they actually believe the Tories were going to come back into power.
And then on Wednesday, we've got the Green Party manifesto being launched down in Brighton. And then on Thursday, I mean, it really is manifesto week, isn't it? On Thursday, we've got the Labour Party manifesto being announced somewhere up north. And we've already seen, even though they've done this sort of like very weighty missions document with lots of ideas in it for how they would start to sort of, you know, repair public services and so on, we haven't heard much policy beyond like fleshing out a bit more detail so far in the campaign. That seems to have changed a bit this week. We had a piece in The Observer on Sunday, which was the announcement of 80 courts specifically to tackle the backlog of rape cases. And then we, as we've already discussed in The Guardian, have this childcare policy. And I anticipate there being a big policy announcement every day until we get to the manifesto launch itself on Thursday. Because I think Labour recognise that while there isn't much money, and you know they, of course, are going to be absolutely scrutinised for every sort of spending pledge, the Tories desperate to leap on it and say, oh, they're going to put up taxes. I do think we'll hear things which are maybe a bit more consumer-focused and about public service reform, so which could potentially make big difference to people's lives but without necessarily costing a lot of money. And it's not just manifesto week, is it? Because Sunak is at the end of the week flying off to the G7, and that was actually one of the things that people in the Tory party were saying after the D-Day fiasco, which was that he would have his big diplomatic moment on the world stage with all these leaders at the G7 in Italy, and that, you know, they'd been anticipating waiting for that. So we have that that. But before he flies off in the middle of the night on Wednesday to Italy, we've got another debate, Kieran.
Yes, we've got the Sky News. I don't know if you call it a debate. We're not.
It's a battle for number 10, they've called it.
Battle for number 10 is their format, isn't it? And they're going to be on stage at different times, is that right?
It's going to be each candidate on the stage on their own. So I don't know who's going to be first, Keir Starmer or Rishi Sunak, but they'll take it in turns. They're going to have what's been described as a forensic interview for 20 minutes from the presenter. We don't know yet which presenter it's going to be, followed by 20 minutes of questions from the audience. And then the next candidate comes on and do the same. And there might be, you know, is this up in Grimsby? Mm-hmm. We've been promised free fish and chips if we go along. So, you know, there's an enticement to a spin room if ever there was one. And it's going to be live. And the first candidate is going to be up at 7:30. And there'll probably be closing statements at the end before Rishi Sunak jumps in his convoy and heads off to the airport to take him to Italy.
I wonder whether that will be a better or worse format than the kind of more combative, you know, 45-second answer format we had last week.
We'll probably hear more because we won't be interrupting each other so much.
Yeah, but I wonder if they'll retreat slightly to their comfort zone as well. They're used to being interviewed, even if it is forensically. You know, they're used to that format. The thing about having them both on stage at the same time is that almost never happens. That happens in PMQs in a very formal way.
Yeah.
You don't often get them really going at it head to head like they did.
Yeah, and they
week.
Weren't comfortable, really, they were they? So no. I think probably be slightly less combative. Mm-hmm. Maybe we'll actually learn more. It might be a case of, you know, more light than heat, the opposite of the debate last week. But I'll certainly be tuning in, fish and chips or not, and, you know, to see how it goes.
I'm looking forward to it.
Well, that's all from us. Please like and follow Politics Weekly UK to make sure you keep getting our episodes in your feed. This episode was produced by Frankie Toby, music by Axel Cocoutier, and the executive producer is Maz Ebtahaj. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
This is The Guardian.
If cybercrime was a country, it would be the third biggest country in the world in terms of gross domestic product. It would also be the fastest growing economy in the world.
Microsoft's chief security advisor, Sarah Armstrong-Smith. But our business is ready for how cybersecurity will be transformed by Gen AI.
Take on tomorrow from PwC's strategy and business.
Guten Tag, pod fans. I didn't write that. Max Rushton here from the Guardian Football Weekly. Euro 2024 kicks off on the 14th of June. We'll be releasing pods every day of the tournament. We'll be joined by pundits across the continent, giving unique and expert insight into every team at the competition, alongside of the host of Guardian journalists out in Germany. Until then, bis bald. Tschüss. New episodes out every day from the 14th of June. Listen wherever you get your podcasts. Tschüssi.